Howard, your hand's up.
Thanks, Paddy. A tour de force, that's all I've got to say.
That's all you're going to say? Oh, well, thank you. Right, okay, well, Paul next.
A few weeks ago, I had an exchange on Facebook with someone who's not a party member, but someone who I think is a member of one of these sort of libertarian communist organizations, probably agrees with us about socialism, not how to get there. Yeah?
Yeah.
And his argument was that housing in socialism wouldn't be a matter of private property the way that you would own your clothes and your record collection, sorry, CD collection or whatever people would have, or your book collection or whatever. But housing would be something that would be communally controlled, so that, for example, you wouldn't hand it on to your kids or anything like that. It's something that maybe would be, when you for whatever reason vacated your home, the community somehow would decide who was going to live there. Which might be an interesting idea, obviously, we can't decide, but housing wouldn't be private property in the same way that private personal property in other respects is. Do you have any thoughts on that, Paddy?
Maybe I didn't make it very, very, very clear. I meant to. Perhaps I kind of assumed it. But, yeah, I mean, it's not private property. It can't be, can it? It's a communal resource. Obviously it is. I sort of alluded to a bit when I talked about going to the local accommodation office, because, I mean, the community, as a community, can decide who gets to live where, on what criteria, you know, I can only guess. But in practical terms, if you've got people turning up, just visiting, you know, tourists, you know, the community can't hold a mass meeting every time someone turns up in town and wants a room. They would delegate this to, you know, an accommodation office or group or committee or whatever. So that's what I was getting at with that. So and the question arises, well, what do you do with all the mansions? There's hundreds and hundreds of stately homes in Britain, and palaces and things around the world. You know, what do we do with those things? When I was youth hosteling in Scotland, I stayed at an absolutely amazing youth hostel, I think somewhere up in Sutherland, and it was a stately home, and they had so many rooms that, you know, people could, there were little dorm rooms, so you could four to a room or something like that, but all sort of marble statues along these big long corridors. It was just glorious. And, you know, we all did a bit of sweeping and cleaning and stuff like that to stay there, very cheap. So I would imagine these stately homes would be sort of, could be used for things like that. But yeah, these things are common resources. And I think I do know, also, speaking of stately homes, I know people that hate the idea of going around stately homes to look at them, because, you know, a lot of them were built on slavery money, and in any case they were built on the exploitation of workers, and they represent elite wealth and this sort of thing. I mean, I think that in socialism these things would be like museum pieces, and people would want to go around them and look at them. And I think the idea that we look askance at these places in socialism is a bit silly. I think it all just becomes sort of common heritage, like old castle ruins and things. Anyway, that's, I've talked enough. I hope that answers the question. Janet, next.
Yes, thank you, Paddy. That was lovely. I think if we wanted to say where is the blueprint for socialism, that can be, your talk could be part of it. It's brilliant, really good. Having lived a long life, touch wood, going to be a longer yet, I have had a lot of experience of different ways of being, and one of my first pleasant experiences was when I went to the village school when I must have been about five. A village school that only had one teacher, one big room, and there was all the ages of the children up till about 11, I suppose, in that room. And it was a really enjoyable time for me, a somewhat isolated, shy child, to be amongst all these different people, sitting at round tables, doing interesting things with acorns and matchboxes. And I look back on that time with much enjoyment, and playing in the playground as well with all the others. I don't think many older children wouldn't want to be mixed with many younger. Maybe not, I don't know. I think we were the younger ones were sat at a table with older ones who were sort of in charge in a way, but it was very limited, of course. Anyway, that got closed and I got moved to a different village and a larger school, and that wasn't too bad either. And the other experience, because had been evacuated in a way, my mother was living in this farmhouse with the farm wife, and they did the housework together. They did the housework and the cooking. And this is 1940s. The farmer's wife was still making her own bread sometimes, and butter. And so I've got experience of looking back over those skills and finding them very, very interesting. I used to turn the handle on the butter churner and the handle on the mangle for the washing. So it was all quite interesting participatory experiences, working in the fields, stuck in the stooks, and other. I know now a lot about farming that I obviously wasn't aware of then. And looking back on that, I think, oh dear, that was not very nice. That was not very good. Wish that hadn't happened. Wish I didn't remember that. But that's the actual farming working part of the life, the actual living together. And my mother, who wasn't a particularly happy woman, I think she was the happiest she's ever been, cooperating with the farmer's wife and what they did together. And So it was a very pleasant time, and it was almost community living, not quite, but almost. And so I would recommend any sharing of housing and skills, because I think that there is a pleasure in them that one doesn't get from an isolated house and isolated jobs that you have to do within the house. I know there are some comrades who wouldn't agree with me, but they may be very private, shy people, and so they wouldn't want to be mixing with a lot of other people. But my experience has been rather different, and in comparison to city life, I think the smaller aspects of social living is to be admired. And as far as the schooling is concerned, yeah, after that village school, for the rest of my schooling life, which was quite limited, but it was regimented, isn't it? It was regimented. I don't know what I learned. I think what I did learn in the 10 years of schooling, I could have learned in about one and a half if I'd put my mind to it, or someone else had helped me. So within capitalism and within the lower levels of schooling, it was a very poor experience. I don't know, it would be nicer from what you hear and read about better off children and some of their schooling. That must have been pretty horrific as well, so we won't go there either. Anyway, that's me rambling on. Thank you for your talk, it was lovely.
Oh, thanks, Sally. Yeah, you mentioned a couple of things. You talked about a village school, being at a village school. And I hadn't really thought about village schools and small classes. I must admit, I was really thinking in terms of my own experience, which is in huge state schools where you've got 2,000 plus students and an army of teachers. But village schools, often very pleasant. And also I was thinking of secondary, not primary, and I think there's a huge difference even today between those two. Primary schools very often are just much more person-centred than secondary, because secondary is all about targets and success rates and league tables and just hideous factories. But I think primary schools are very often just much more comfortable places for children to be. Unfortunately, they then go on to secondary, which is pretty horrible. And then you mentioned, I mean, the best you can hope for with today's capitalist school system is that it doesn't destroy people's love of learning. And lots of us sort of retained the love of learning despite the capitalist school. So, you know, I'm possibly in danger of painting it grimmer than it necessarily is, but I think for a lot of people it is really grim. And I think one of the problems that a lot of workers have got is they just don't want to learn anything. They don't want to know, because they did all that at school and they don't want any more of it. And that's, of course, a problem for us as well. We're trying to explain a system of society to people who don't want to learn. Just one other thing, you mentioned about farm work, making butter and bread and that sort of thing. I actually make my own bread. I really enjoy doing it, and I think in socialism, you know, I can imagine us rediscovering the simple pleasure of basic sort of types of, you know, handiwork and handicrafts and practical things that we're all in danger of forgetting, because, you know, we're described as consumers. You know, I hate that term. It just makes us sound like sort of giant hungry mouths that just guzzle and guzzle and guzzle and don't do anything. The other thing about farms I was going to say was that, everybody works on a farm. Children work on a farm. I discovered that the term wool gathering, which means, you know, to be off in a bit of a daze, a bit dreamy, wool gathering is actually what children did. They'd go out for the day and just gather bits of wool from off the hedges and things, and it was just something that children were able to do that was easy, and they enjoyed it, and they spent all day doing it, and it was productive. So yeah, anyway, so work doesn't have to be unpleasant or hard. I've rambled on. Howard again. Howard, your hand's still up, is it? Sorry, Howard, I can't hear you at all.
Okay.
Oh, that's better.
Can you hear me now?
Sorry. Yeah, that's better.
Sorry to come back so quickly. Since we're talking about education...
Oh, no, you've gone faint again.
Okay. Right, can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's good.
Right, sorry, there's something wrong with this. Sorry to come back so quickly, but since we're talking about education...
You've gone faint again.
Sorry about this. Right, I'm going to have to kick the cat off this chair. Right, can you hear me now?
Yes.
if you stop hearing me, let me know. I'm not sure what's going on here. Right, again, since we're talking about education, and you mentioned three names I've not heard for a long time, A.S. Neil, Ivan Illich, and John Holmes. They were sort of de-schooling educators, if you like, or free educators. I think a long time ago, and I'm so old I can't remember it now, I think I wrote an article in The Standard about home education, etc., because my own son, for the first few years of his school age life, was educated at home. Not so much because of me, but because of my ex-wife was very interested in that kind of thing. And I think it's fair to say it worked pretty well, because and he learned just as much, not more, as his friends, his local friends did, not being at school, as they learned at school. Not much doubt about that. He used to play with them sort of after school, etc. Worked very well indeed. Ivan Illich talked about de-schooling society, it obviously sort of that kind of thing suits some people but not others. It's very, very difficult for people to do that, obviously, most of the time, because they've got to go to work, etc. But it's certainly something that's, the party has never sort of thought about that that closely when it comes to thinking about the kind of society socialism will be, and definitely sort of worth thinking about. I had something more to say, but it slipped out my mind now. Sorry about that. But can I just say one other thing? You were talking about people, about, you know, on farms, the kind of thing people learn. Absolutely true. I mean, I've got new next door neighbours, and he, the father of the family, is actually a social scientist who works at Cardiff University, but he was brought up on a farm in Ireland, and he can do absolutely everything in the house. He can build, he can plaster, he can do absolutely everything here that you'd want to do if you were, you know, if you were sort of putting a house in order. And he can do lots of other things as well, which is sort of quite mind-boggling, simply because he learned them sort of, you know, through the pores, as it were, when he was a kid. So all sorts of things can be learned which aren't learned in this society, because things are so sort of narrowly directed when you're young. Thanks anyway, Paddy. Thanks again.
Oh, thanks, Howard. I unfortunately was one of those who never got taught any of these skills, and I've just found it debilitates in my entire life to not be able to do anything. I've tried to sort of do bits of DIY and certain things, and you know, it's doable, but it's an uphill struggle. And I'm always in awe of people who can do everything, like your neighbour friend. So anyway, sorry, Andy, you've had your hand up for ages, so I'm sorry to keep you waiting. So it's over to you.
No problem. Can I be heard? Okay.
Yeah.
Just as everybody else has said, Paddy, thanks for the talk. It's we couldn't disagree with anything really there. But it was lovely actually to hear Howard's observation about his new neighbour. It really made me think about my grandfather, Patrick Murphy, who came from rural Western Ireland and on the family farm over there. And Granddad came over and in, I think it was 1956, and he turned his hand to working on building and drain laying and all sorts of things, and took those transferable skills. I was thinking about your comments about farming, though, before Howard made that comment, and I was thinking it was a bloody hard life for my family on the farm back then. But that was because they were just there on their own, trying to manage this sort of, I don't know what the term is really. I suppose it was a feudal sort of life, really. Where the capitalist market was coming in, and that sort of model of farming wasn't going to be sustainable, really. But generally, like, positive about that. And also the other comment, I'm not sure if I've got the right take on this, but I think my take is a positive one as well, about Marx's comment about the town becomes the country and the country becomes the town. And I heard this sort of as a sort of slogan, years and years ago, and it sort of struck something of a chord with me in a good way. And it resonated with your comments about this sort of idea of, I'm not quite sure exactly how you put it, like a village or towns, quite modern. I use the word advisedly, but it's the best way I can explain it. Modern sort of villages, modern towns, having everything available within 15 minutes, but also within environments where there's green space. It's a pleasant place to be. As I would sort of explain it, you know, with green spaces and so on. And it's sort of, I actually think that's a really good model for post-capitalist sort of planning, you know, in terms of planning of the urban environments, where you've got the best facilities, you know, the best of everything in terms of, well, in my case, I mean, I'm quite lucky in that way. Where I live, I've got a convenience shop at the top of my little lane. I've got a post box. I've got other facilities, a bus stop just at the top as well. These sorts of things, you know, these sort of small suburbs are nice places to live, really. And I think that would be something, again, I'd be really sort of supportive, and you know, I think it sounds great. And also, actually, the other thing that you talked about you said something about the statics and the, I can't remember the other word for the other youngsters who would be more inquisitive about the world and would want to travel about more, reminded me of my old Birmingham branch comrade Ron Cook, who introduced me to the Socialist Party. Ron thought that people in socialism would live in hotels or something akin to hotels, and would move around a lot. You know, I'm not sure about that or whether it would suit everybody. But that was one of Ron's sort of ideas, and I think he put that into his book, Yes Utopia. Yeah, the only thing I did think, just from a kind of a little bit of challenge there, to put a bit of challenge into what you were talking about, Paddy, from a sort of social cohesion perspective, was I think you said something about some of the more skilled people who would be more static would require more, I'm not sure how you put this. You didn't say it like this, so please don't, you know, take it the wrong way. But you said something like they would need more resourced housing, more effectively, more better facilities, because they'd be staying in those facilities, those homes, for longer. And I just wondered whether that could create friction within any communities, you know, around that, and sort of, you know, cause some sort of post-capitalist de facto jealousies, you know, into worker jealousy. So, you know, I think it's something that may as well put that on the table out there. So anyway, I've rambled a bit, so thanks very much.
Thanks, Andy. Yeah, just to take up that last point first, what I meant was that people who are staying in one place, whether, you know, I also mentioned that they would be like, they would be doing the more sort of in-depth skilled work, that, rather than, you know, if you're going flying around from place to place, you know, you don't mind sweeping floors or helping out in a local hospital or something, you know, doing a low skilled thing. But if you're staying in the same place, you're in a position then to sort of learn something in more depth and become more expert at it. And I was simply saying that people who are staying in one place, the statics, are going to want more from their accommodation than people who are only going to stay there for 3 days. So I didn't mean to say that, you know, the professor down the road wants a big house and he wants a bigger house than I've got because I'm not a professor. I didn't mean that in the least. The idea of people wanting to live in hotels. I understand what Ron Cook was saying, because I think he had a similar idea about people just being on the move a lot. But I think that as you get older, we see this now in cities. You get young people moving into cities to find work, but they're looking for relationships and they're looking for fun and to have a good time and go to clubs and things like that and meet up in pubs. So cities are great. City centres are great for that. But the demographics of cities look like dartboards with concentric circles. And as you go further out from the centre, through the concentric circles, the demographic age is, you know, it ages in years, because people settle down, they get married or have kids or whatever, and then they move out to the suburbs. And so that's the sort of state situation now. And I'm thinking of a similar kind of thing in socialism, where, you know, people would want to move around a lot to see the world, but then they, at some point, they might want to settle with somebody, or just maybe they want to go back to where they were first brought up. In any case, they can still travel when they want, but, you know, they're more likely to be settled later in life. So that was my thinking on that. You mentioned before that this idea of de-urbanisation sounds quite attractive. It does, I think. I agree. I mean, I think we'd all agree. I don't think we need to go quite down the William Morris route of wooden houses in the middle of forests. Appealing though that might sound, I think the crucial factor here is energy for transport. Now, if we had good energy supplies, either from renewables, or, you know, if fusion ever becomes a thing in the future, and we could have, you know, essentially unlimited energy for transport, then all bets are off, really. I mean, then people could just live any damn place they pleased. But as things are, with energy being somewhat out of premium, I think the tendency would be for people to urbanise, to stay central, stay near all the facilities and so forth. So I think the tendency at the moment is to continue urbanisation. But saying that, as I think I mentioned, you know, you can have urban farms, you can have vertical farming, all sorts of things you can do in cities, so they don't have to be concrete jungles. Yeah, okay. Anybody else? Freddie.
Yeah, thanks, Paddy. And I mean, you know, like everyone else, as those that have spoken anyway have mentioned, yeah, very, very interesting talk. And I'm sure that certainly most people attending here tonight will have given thoughts to not far from where you are, just now, along the lines of what socialism could be like, without perhaps trying to be too prescriptive on it, and that the idea of the democracy and such like, and the idea of education and so on, as the socialist movement grows, you know, other thinkings will, I would imagine that other thinkings will start to arise also how society is going to look, or how it's going to react in terms of the global community, if you want to put it that way. And like one or two others have mentioned there, when I was just a young lad living in Glasgow, my father was in the fire service and lived in a fire station. And that fire station was more or less a community to some extent on its own, that, you know, we went up, went to school in the morning, come back, and our houses, or the parents' house, the houses were above where the fire stations and where the fire engines and such like were. And the children of the families that lived in the station largely sort of played with each other, because it was a big rectangular fire station that we lived in, and we could play football and such like there without even having to go outside, although we did. You know, obviously we went to school and met other children, etc., at school. So, I mean, I think examples can be given just now to some extent of People definitely can and do sort of cooperate with each other to a large extent just now. I mean, someone else mentioned earlier on about a farm, and after I left school, I went to work at, I didn't go to work, I was at an agricultural horticultural college, and learned there about farming, so it put all horticulture and agriculture. And in my life now, I've mentioned before about, you know, I mean, I still have quite an interest in gardening. And up until a few months back, had an allotment for quite a few years, which has had to fall by the wayside for personal reasons. But even in the sort of allotment community, there's lots of people acting and interacting with each other all the time, and perhaps growing different vegetables and so on and sharing them. But the only thing I'd be a bit cautious of, as I say, is, and I'm not suggesting that you are part of, because I mean, from my perspective, you're throwing out ideas, etc. There, I think we need to be cautious that with the current numbers that we have, that some thinking, I believe that some thinking will start to change as the socialist movement grows. But nonetheless, you've given plenty of food for thought tonight. Thanks.
Thanks, Willie. I wonder what conversations William Morris had after he wrote News from Nowhere. Among his friends, I wonder if they all said, well, you know, you've got some good ideas there, but, you know, as the socialist movement develops, thinking will change. Very probably, actually, and correctly too. So you're right, Freddie. Obviously, we always have to be sure that, make sure that we're not sounding prescriptive, we're only sounding speculative, and of course that's always good advice. And of course, you know, we should also underline that one size doesn't fit all. That what people do in one place or one, you know, geographical area doesn't necessarily look the same as what people do in another. There are other views of out there about a future society. I'm thinking of the Venus Project, which, if you've any of you have seen the films, the Zeitgeist films specifically about the Venus Project, it's like a sort of Thunderbirds Argo set, where it's all incredibly futuristic. There are circular runways and all sorts of stuff, and it's all chrome and steel and glass and, you know, little ornamental spot trees and, you know, little model plastic people. I found that really off-putting. What I didn't like about it was that the designer of the Venus Project, Jacques Fresco, he was basically saying, well, this is how we should all live. You know, that's because he wanted to live like that. You know, he liked the idea of living in a Thunderbird set, and so he was saying that's how we'll all live in the future. And I thought this was quite counterproductive, really, because which is precisely your point, Freddie. This is why, precisely why we can't be prescriptive, because, you know, there are going to be people who will say, well, I don't want to live like that, therefore I don't want socialism, I would rather have capitalism. It sounds silly, but people would be very likely to say that. So so I didn't fancy the Venus Project, but at the same time, you know, News from Nowhere just seems sort of gloriously romantic and Victorian. So somewhere in the middle, I think I'm sort of with Andy on this. You know, I like the kind of town and country fusing to some extent, if possible. I think I've answered that point. Richard's got your hand up. You're next.
Hi, Paddy. Absolutely brilliant. I don't really know
if I've got anything kind of sensible to say about this, except that you've just got me feeling so enthusiastic, I feel I want to say something. I think I agree with you about the Venus Project. When they split off from the Zeitgeist, I remember his partner, Fresco's partner, Roxanne, explaining why they split off from the Zeitgeist movement, because in her view, only Jacques Fresco understood what was absolutely necessary. And I think that's the kind of attitude that we really, really kind of need to avoid at all costs. I'm sorry if I'm saying something that others have said before. I just had to take a 10-minute break with a phone call. But yeah, there's so many things that actually occurred to me while you were talking. I think that, I mean, what my experience is that when we're talking to left-wingers, they tend to want to kind of argue with us about capitalism. When we're talking to right-wingers or other people who oppose anything of the kind that we're suggesting, it very often comes down to, well, how is it going to work? I think we need really to kind of look at this more more commonly. I think perhaps we talk to left-wingers more often, so we get sort of stuck in this whole sort of way in which we, you know, we talk about capitalism and our antagonism to capitalism and so on. But I think we need more of this. And you were saying so many of the things that I've been kind of playing with over the years, and other people have been talking about their personal experience. And one of the things that it kind of brought up for me is that when I was in my 20s, and again, more recently after I retired, I spent quite a lot of time vagabonding, just wandering around Europe or more recently around the Middle East, around India, around the Caucasus. And it was the most incredibly freeing experience of my life. I just kind of, it just exploded my understanding of what life could actually be like when I was doing that. And I have lots of motorcycle vagabonding friends, people who spent years just, I mean, I was talking to a friend, Trevor, the other day, who has actually spent 18 years on a motorcycle just traveling around the world. And he's an ecologist by training, and he will stop off at a project here and there, and he'll spend his time helping out on this project or that project, and then he'll move on a whim to somewhere else, and so on and so forth. And I do think that there is a nomad in a lot of us, and we need that experience to actually live a fulfilling life. And it's one of the reasons, like, why you know, talks like this kind of make me re-enthuse me for socialism, because it reminds me of, you know, the potentialities. You can get so bogged down with kind of being critical of capitalism, saying what is horrible about the system, that we forget why we're socialists in a way. I mean, I know we don't, but, you know, in the fullness of that appreciation of what socialism can actually mean to us. You know, you were talking about schools, and I had a really pretty horrific schooling, and I went to a really ruthless and barbaric boarding school. I have plenty of stories that I kind of tell people if they've got strong stomachs and want to hear. But, you know, it's like the release from that into the world was just sort of explosive for me, and that's when I started traveling quite a lot. So yeah, I really hope we. I was furiously scribbling notes down as you were writing. Didn't get down half of what I wanted to get down, and you know, for me, exploring all this kind of stuff is so liberating. That's me. I've just been enthusing, so I've enthused out now. So thank you. Cheers.
Okay. Thanks, Richard. I've heard in the past, so some members are sort of look askance at this kind of conversation. I know certain members who really don't think that much of it and think, bit of a waste of time, really we should be talking about the here and now, the class struggle, you know, what's the point of building castles in the air? you know, this sort of argument, and in any case, we can't be creating cookshops. You know, all this, and you know, there's a truth to all of that. But on the other hand, I've always thought one of the main reasons that people just don't understand us when we talk about socialism is they can't see a picture of it. They don't. We don't describe it in practice. We don't describe what it would look like. And so people just don't get it. And right-wingers always just assume we're Soviet communists or we're, you know, Maoists or some shit. They just can't see it. Because, you know, I think, you know, for better or worse, the sort of, well, if I can use the term conservatives in the party, you know, the ones who think, well, we shouldn't be doing that sort of thing, we shouldn't be speculating, we should be talking about the here and now. Well, they've tended to always have it their way. And, you know, conversations like this tend to be the sort of thing that people have in the pub or after the pub, after several pints and in small groups. And it never really forms part of the party, you know, discussion, party discourse. You don't find it in pamphlets. You know, we just never make a thing about a thing of it. I've always thought we've really missed a big trick. You know, if people could see what we're talking about, they would get it. They really would. And you know, why I mentioned, I wondered if you'd be here actually, Richard, when I was talking about the Inuits, because you know a lot about hunter-gatherer communities and societies. This sort of thing, and you could probably give me chapter and verse on the number of so-called primitive communist groups at the Rhino. They're not all like that, but where was I going with that with that sentence? People think, oh, socialism won't work because it's against human nature, and of course. We can show, or you can certainly show. Look at these human societies that didn't look at it like that, that didn't behave this way. In fact, I've actually got a quote from this Inuit website. Let me just read you this little thing that this Inuit says. Apparently, Inuit is a plural noun, and it means the people, and the singular of Inuit is Inuk. Anyway, this particular Inuk says, he just said this thing. He said, this is where we all live, so it is territory that belongs to all of us, which makes land disputes between neighbours quite pointless. And he goes on to say, we are a peace-loving people who believe that humankind is made up of myriad civilizations and nations who, if they act as one, can bring hope and security to life itself. What a profound and poignant observation from people who, you know, live on ice and eat raw raw meat, or at least in their original sort of culture did. It's things like that, I think, that speak to people at a level where all our talk about economics and current affairs just doesn't reach them. Anyway, I've said enough again. So, anybody else want to say anything? I've just noticed it's 9 o'clock. Is this a good time to call it a day, if nobody else has got anything to say?
Thanks, Paddy.
Okay, then. All right, then. Well, thank you all very much for listening.
Good night, all, and thanks, Paddy.
Thank you, Paddy.
Next week, it'll be Paul Bennett on the subject of work. So, see you all then.
Thank you very much,
Paddy. Good night.